Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Justin Chekai, who's serving as our worship associate, and our music director, Hal Walker. I'd like to call to your attention the arrival of our Easter tree. The Easter tree will be decorated over the course of the month with paper eggs that will magically turn into real live chicks. Read all about it and find out more about how you can help make that happen downstairs in Fessenden Hall. Orlando Brugnola was a Unitarian Universalist minister who was an inspiration and mentor of mine, and she died last week. We light the chalice with these words in appreciation for her, her life, and her ministry. Flame, friend of our most ancient ancestors, we kindle you now to make you visible in this time. Yet in truth, you burn always, in the unique worth of each person, in the imagination, in the turning of the heart to sorrow or joy, in the call to hope, and in the call to justice. Burn bright before us, burn bright within us.
Raised song singing, raised voices ringing, move forward into that light.
We're all equal
voices, giving songs for the living. Sing as we soar through the night.
We're just people. What if today we walk in the light,
knowing we're all equal now?
Wouldn't it be something to see?
We're all equal, no matter the skin, with money or none.
We are all just people, wow.
How does it feel not to be free?
We're just people
walking forward into the day. We're all equal, voices calling. Hope is on the way. We're just people.
We are the ones who are walking, walking forward into the light of the day.
We're all equal voices. Our praise song is calling, calling for all people to sing on your way.
We're just people.
Praise song singing, raised voices are ringing, move forward into that light. We're all equal voices, giving songs for the living, sing as we soar through the night.
We're just people, praise the
Lord,
singing,
raise the voices of ringing, move forward into that light.
We're all equal voices,
giving songs for the living, sing as we soar through the night.
We're all equal,
voices,
no matter the skin, with money or not, we are all just people, wow.
Sing as we soar
now to be free.
We're just people walking forward into the day. We're all equal, voices calling. Just people.
Good morning. My family has been coming to this church for somewhere around 10 years now. It's an amazing place full of such wonderful people and infinite energy. But I wonder if any of you know how we first arrived here. Since Jacqueline and I both came from extremely Catholic upbringings, can you guess what brought us here? It's a glamorous story. We arrived at this church because we took a quiz on the internet. Yes, the old Belief-O-Matic website. Based on your answers to their questions, it would tell you what religion you are most likely to enjoy. Consequently, both Jacqueline and I had UU at the top of our lists. Once the internet told us what religion we should be, we decided to check it out. Living in Streetsboro at the time, Jacqueline was excited to announce that there was a church in Kent that we should visit, and so we did. Now, the first service was a little unnerving for me because there was like all this singing and hand gestures about lighting some chalice and stuff, and people greeting each other with handshakes during service, and some of them were wearing shorts, for heaven's sake. And oh my goodness, there was a lady minister delivering such a powerful message in such a petite package. It was like a free-for-all. But I loved it. The next service that we attended, we performed a meditation on a clementine. Seeing it, feeling it, smelling it, tasting it. I remember the whole church smelling like citrus. It was unreal. Jacqueline and I always love the philosophies and practices of the Eastern religions, but to practice it in church is like sacrilege. But I loved it even more. The third service featured a lot of singing and the musical talents of Mr. Hal Walker. I walked out of the church feeling like I was on cloud nine. It was one of the best feelings I've ever had. Like, you know, after you've had a really good cry, or you've just sat down with somebody who listened to all your problems, and the whole world just fell off your shoulders. It just felt amazing. After much reflection on that service, I remember sitting with Jacqueline later that night, and with total and urgent concern, I looked at her and I asked, "Are we getting involved in a cult? Isn't this the stuff you read about cults doing to you?" And her answer was, "I don't know. I don't think so." So now we've spent almost a decade in the church, and we have yet been asked to drink the Kool-Aid. So I'm pretty sure it's not a cult. But in all sincerity, I love our services. I love the people that I've met. I love that I've been able to find an outlet for my creativity. There's so much freedom, both intellectually and spiritually, to simply be yourself in this church. The freedom is nurtured in our Sunday worship by our voices, our music, and our messages. So this morning, let us celebrate the legacy and promise of a free church. This is a story of how a boy found out that his Unitarian Universalist grandmother and grandfather were heroes. As an eighth grader in New York City, a boy named Artemis Jakowski III chose his grandmother to interview for a school assignment. His grandmother was named Martha Sharp. Telling his grandparents' story is a way to pass along the question that Martha Sharp posed to Artemis throughout his life. What are you going to do that is important in your life? On a snowy night in Prague in 1936, Martha Sharp jumped from a taxi, darted around a corner, and flattened herself into a doorway. The heels of a pursuing Gestapo agent clicked past her. She entered an unlit apartment building, dashed up five flights of stairs, and rang the bell of a known anti-Nazi leader. Now, 6 weeks earlier, Martha and her husband, Reverend Waitstill Sharp, had left their young children safely behind in the United States so that they could volunteer for a relief effort in Czechoslovakia, sponsored by the American Unitarian Association. Then one night in 1939, the Nazi army marched into Prague, the capital of Czechoslovakia, and occupied the city. The helping mission of the Sharps instantly changed into a treacherous cloak-and-dagger mission. So back to that March night. There was a woman that opened the apartment door to Martha, and she denied ever hearing of the man that Martha was asking for. "I begged," Martha recounted the story later to a biographer. "I told her that there was little time. I produced my American passport." When she saw it, she said in Czech, "A moment," and snatched the passport from me and shut the door in my face. For the next few minutes, Martha frantically worried whether she'd ever see her passport again. Her passport was her only ticket to safety. Finally, the door opened. A man stood before her, and Martha asked if he was Mr. X. He said that he could give a message to Mr. X, and she explained that she had been trusted by a group of British and American refugee workers to transport Mr. X to the British embassy so that he could be smuggled out of the country. The man asked her to wait a moment and disappeared into the apartment. He opened the door again, this time wearing a trench coat. He handed Martha her passport and said, "I am Mr. X." Together they walked through the wind and snow across the city. A Nazi soldier stopped them when they reached the bridge over the Vlada River. Martha produced her passport and confidently announced, "We are Americans." They were waved across the bridge. However, they were stopped again by another soldier on the opposite side of the bridge. Martha again stated that they were Americans and they were allowed to pass. They continued until they were just steps outside the embassy when a third Gestapo agent stopped them. Martha began to complain at the lack of taxis and expressed her frustration for being late to a meeting with the embassy secretary. She flashed her passport and demanded that the guard tell the secretary, "Mr. and Mrs. Sharp are here." The Gestapo agent directed them to speak to a British guard, and Martha and Mr. X walked into the embassy, safe at last. Martha then returned to her apartment where her husband, Waitstill, was returning from a similar mission. They watched out the window as the Nazi soldiers spread across Prague, looting and destroying stores and warehouses. The rescue of Mr. X is one of hundreds that the couple orchestrated, helping Jews, non-Jews, intellectuals, political leaders, writers, artists, and children flee to safety from the Nazis. Yet the heroism on Martha and Waitstill Sharp is just beginning to be recognized. This story of the Sharps' courage illuminates some of the dilemmas that confront people who care about social justice. How many of us want to help, but are afraid or don't know how? Taking a courageous stand does not require the sacrifice and heroics on the scale of the Sharps. It's easy to feel small in comparison to Waitstill and Martha Sharp. Not every one of us wants to set out for war-torn Europe, but every one of us wants to help those who do. In sharing his grandparents' experience, Artemis Joukowsky wanted their story to inspire others, but not overwhelm them. Life is made of rich, righteous moments, but not grandiose moments, he says, by making choices that require you to reflect on how you treat everyone in your life. The key part about my grandparents wasn't just one big moment. It was all the thousands of little choices that led up to the story that we now tell. Artemis remembers his grandmother, Martha Sharp, asking him, "What are you going to do that is important in your life?" Even now that he's grown up, married, and a father of three children, he still hears her words. As a child, Artemis always answered the same way, "I'm going to overcome my disease," referring to his lifelong battle with spinal muscular atrophy, which is a progressive illness. Today, he's become an advocate for disability rights and is also the author of Raising the Bar, New Horizons in Disabled Sports. Telling his grandparents' story is a way to pass along to you, a new generation, the question that Martha Sharp asked him. What are you going to do that is important in your life?
To lead us into a time of silence, meditation, and prayer, words from William Ellery Channing, who was one of the first Unitarian ministers in this country. This is from a sermon that he delivered called Spiritual Freedom. "I call that mind free which jealously guards its intellectual rights and powers, which does not content itself with a passive or hereditary faith, which opens itself to light whensoever it may come, which receives new truth as an angel from heaven. I call that mind free which is not passively framed by outward circumstances and is not the creature of accidental impulse, which discovers everywhere the radiant signatures of the infinite spirit and in them finds help to its own enlargement. I call that mind free which protects itself against the usurpations of society and which does not cower to human opinion, which refuses to be the slave or the tool of the many or of the few, and guards its empire over itself as nobler than the empire of the world. I call that mind free, which sets no bounds to its love, which, wherever they are seen, delights in virtue and sympathizes with suffering, which recognizes in all human beings the image of God and the rights of God's children, and offers itself up as a willing sacrifice to the cause of humanity. And I invite you to join with me now in the spirit of prayer. Sometimes prayer is a focusing on a question, and so this prayer today will largely be your own, as I invite you to consider within yourself, in quite concrete terms, what it is that love is calling you to do next. What is love calling you to do next in your life? Love is ever calling us on, and our work is to listen as well as we can and to respond as faithfully as we can. May we find the courage and the strength of will to listen and heed the call of love in our own lives. Amen.
Ours is a simple faith. Life is a short embrace. Heaven is in this place every day. Hope is the round we tell. May each day that in her voice you hear every day. Life's not a goal or race. It's about heart and faith and living a life of grace every day. Ours is a
Thomas Shade is a retired UNU minister who writes a popular blog called The Lively Tradition. This is an excerpt from Accessible and Holistic. How can people access the social movements that are bubbling up all across the country? If you live in an all-white suburb, how do you access the Black Lives Matter movement? If you live in Kansas, how do you respond to the inspiration of the young adults who suspended themselves off that bridge in Portland, Oregon, to stop a Shell icebreaker needed for Arctic drilling? If you have limited free time and unlimited family responsibilities, how do you connect to the transformative social movements? You can read about them, you can watch them on TV, you can sign up for an email and get an email a day from them, an email sent by a robot that's going to ask you for money. The local Unitarian Universalist Church should be a point of access to the movements, a place where you can make that connection. At least, it should be a community of people who share your interest, where you can hear about the things going on. It should give you a chance to sing a song and clap your hands, if nothing else. At most, it should be able to connect you to people across the country who are doing great things and who will support you in testing the limits of your commitment. A Unitarian Universalist congregation is also a holistic, a transformational community that deals with all aspects of life. It's not a movement organization, but a transformational community. Move On does not teach progressive values and ignite wonder in the children of people on its email list. The ACLU does not provide all ages sexual education for its members. The Green Party will not visit you in the hospital when you are sick, and no one from Bernie Sanders' campaign will conduct your mother's memorial service. None of those organizations intend to help you make meaning from your life. They do not have a spiritual dimension, but Unitarian Universalism does. Unitarian Universalist congregations already do many of these functions. Where they fall short is they fail to clearly identify themselves in the public square as manifestations of movement of the spirit of liberation. They say that they are inclusive and that they are holistic, but they appear to the outsider as small, tight, caring communities whose highest purpose is taking care of the people themselves. Social movements that are engaging are not one movement, but they share a common spirit, a spirit of liberation and justice and solidarity. The good news is we ought to proclaim, says the good news that we ought to proclaim is that the spirit is just about the most precious and holiest thing that ever can be. It is a great transforming, sustaining, and creating power that holds us together. Our goal of work is to make sure that every person knows that their local UU congregation is a place where they can bring their whole self to touch and be touched by the rising spirit of resistance and liberation.
Our next hymn was written for the merger of the Unitarian and the Universalist Associations, and it was written to capture both the past of those traditions and to imagine the future. Will you please rise and join in singing as Tranquil Streams, number 145. I wanted to sing that hymn today because with just four little lines, the second stanza gets right to the heart of Unitarian Universalist values. The first two lines basically sum up the views of the people who established the first Unitarian and Universalist congregations in this country. Free from the bonds that bind the mind to narrow thought and lifeless creed. Freedom has always been and still remains at the center of our religious tradition. The piece that I read earlier from William Allery Channing from his sermon, Spiritual Freedom, is a testament to this legacy. As an architect of classical Unitarianism in this country, Channing defended the right to use reason in religious life. He argued that reason is a gift of God, and therefore it is right and good to use God's gift in interpreting God's word. Channing championed the value of intellectual freedom in all matters of faith, especially in reading the Bible, and he encouraged people to be open to the possibility of new truth from wherever it may come. And people listened to him, and that's how we got to be here today, ever following new truth as it broke forth into the minds of people who listened faithfully. Channing also defended the power of spiritual freedom. His preaching was created and delivered in the context of widespread Calvinism, and it may be hard for us to imagine, just as his language can be a little bit hard to hear clearly in 200 years later, but in his context, everyone around him affirmed a vengeful and wrathful God. That was the context of Calvinism. People were viewed as sinful and depraved. A sermon title that you may have heard of from the Great Awakening captured that spirit very well, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." That was the ethos in which Calvin began preaching. In contrast, he defended the moral perfection of God, defining God as infinitely just, infinitely good, and infinitely holy. Channing imaged God as a loving father who wanted to elicit, to call forth, to pull out the best from his children. And Channing believed that all people, because they were created in the image of God, had the capacity to find the best within themselves, that they were capable of growing in likeness to God by working on their own moral and spiritual development. In his sermon, Channing said that the free mind sets no bounds to its love and recognizes in all human beings the image of God and the rights of God's children. Channing and his contemporaries in the ministry devoted themselves to the articulation of freedom in religious life, which they understood to have both personal and social dimensions, though their preaching, to be honest, often emphasized the personal dimensions of the free mind and the free heart. But the people who heard those sermons, the people who were members of the Unitarian congregation Channing served and those his contemporaries served, heard that message of intellectual and spiritual freedom, and many of them found ways to apply it in the world. Unitarians were active in the movements of their time, the justice movements of their time, the work of abolition of slavery, rights for women, universal education for children, compassionate treatment for the mentally ill and for the imprisoned. And it's important to realize that just like there is often controversy and confusion about the justice movements of our day, there was controversy and confusion about the justice movements of their day too. And so not everyone who was a Unitarian at the time applied that message of spiritual and intellectual freedom to the public square, but some people did. The Unitarian and Universalist social reformers of the 19th century, who led the way in the liberation movements of their time, saw clearly a link between their own quest for spiritual freedom and the work of creating freedom in the world in which they lived. Free from the bonds that bind the mind to narrow thought and lifeless creed, free from a social code that fails to meet the cause of human need. Right there in just four lines, the hymn speaks to both the internal and the external dimensions of the quest for freedom. And I think that there has often been a tension between these two dimensions in our history. Many people have criticized those 19th century Unitarian writers and preachers for being too individualistic and too concerned with their own individual, moral, intellectual, and spiritual freedom. One person who criticized them in the moment, at the time that they were writing and preaching, was named Orestes Brownson. Orestes Brownson was a true spiritual seeker. He was a universalist who later converted to Unitarianism, in part because of the influence of Channing's preaching. And then, after spending some time within the Unitarian communion, he converted again to Catholicism. And converted in part because of his disillusionment with the limits of the focus on freedom that he saw practiced amongst him. He wrote an essay called The Laboring Classes, and in it he said, self-culture, and by that, I used that phrase maybe a couple months ago talking about Emerson. He used it a lot, self-culture, which translates basically moral and spiritual development. So Orestes Brownson said, self-culture is a good thing, but it cannot abolish inequality nor restore men to their rights. As a means, it is well. As an end, it is nothing. I think that over the years, there's been a kind of pendulum swinging back and forth between the internal and the external, the public and the private dimensions of freedom in our religious tradition. It seems to me that the internal and personal dimensions of freedom are often characterized now in our contemporary language as the quest for individual spirituality, while the external and social dimensions of freedom are often characterized as the quest for social justice. Both of these quests are essential parts of what it means to be Unitarian Universalist, but I sometimes hear people pit them against each other or argue that one is more important, spirituality or social justice. The emphasis of the writers and the preachers of the Transcendentalist movement who followed that establishment of classical Unitarianism, they tended to put their emphasis upon the internal and personal dimensions of freedom. The Transcendentalists were all about finding a unique revelation of divinity in the world. They wanted it for themselves. And so they developed practices, prayer practices, journal practices, being out in nature, so that they could find that inspiration, that connection to divinity for themselves. And they wanted other people to have it too, so they wrote essays and they preached lectures about how you could do this, how you too could go out and find a unique revelation of divinity in the world. The Unitarian and Universalist ministers who were influenced after them by the 20th century social gospel movement emphasized, instead of the personal internal dimensions, they emphasized the external application of the dimensions of freedom in the world. They were all about working for social salvation rather than personal salvation. And so some of the ministers who emphasized that, the Unitarian John Haynes Holm and the Universalist Clarence Skinner, often said, the quest for your own personal spirituality is all well and good, but your work in the world, they would tell people, your work in the world is to apply that freedom and to make sure that it is accessible to as many people as possible. As a Unitarian minister who was serving the congregation in Wellesley, Massachusetts, Wade Still Sharp would surely have been acquainted with the social gospel movement. And I believe that it must have affected his choices and his wife Martha's choices. In many ways, their story is truly incredible. It sounds like a movie, and in fact, it is going to be a movie that will come out in September of this year. The grandson who wrote the story that Justin shared this morning is the documentary filmmaker of his parents' life. You may have heard of them before, Martha and Wade Still Sharp, because their story has received quite a lot of attention. In 2005, they became only the second and third people from the United States to be named Righteous Among the Nations by Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Martyrs and Heroes Remembrance Authority in Israel. Their story is a proud and powerful story of liberation. A married minister and social worker leave behind their comfortable lives in suburban Wellesley, Massachusetts, to carry out urgently needed humanitarian work with Jewish refugees in Czechoslovakia. For the next 6 years, they dedicated themselves to providing relief services to refugees fleeing Nazi Europe and literally physically accompanied people who intended to emigrate from Eastern Europe to shores, often in Portugal and other places along the coast where they could catch ships to emigrate to other places in the world. The Sharps risked personal harm on more than one occasion, and still they persisted. They also became two of the five co-founders of the Unitarian, now Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. They did not watch and lament from the sidelines back home. They took action and they helped save the lives of many, many people. The Sharps devoted themselves to social justice by working for collective salvation. And yet there's another side to their story. When they left for their work in Europe, Martha and Wade Still left behind two children who were just 3 and 8 years old at the time. They left them in the care of friends and family members. And they really were not able to parent them because they were gone for much of the next 6 years. The children bore part of the burden for their efforts. And their marriage bore part of the burden too, When they finally returned from Europe permanently, the Sharps were divorced. Theirs is a powerful, important, and complicated story. With two children, young children in my home right now, I can't imagine making the choice that they made. But I can imagine feeling called to take a stand for justice in a way that demands something of me. And that has happened to me more than once in my life, and I suspect that it will happen again. As I consider the value of freedom and my own faith, I realize that I have tremendous appreciation and respect for both the private, the internal, and the public dimensions of freedom. I'm a Unitarian Universalist because this is a free faith. In my own spiritual journey, I would have nothing less than the freedom to seek the truth in love and interpret it according to my own best light. And I'm a Unitarian Universalist because this faith, I believe, is also committed at its core to freedom for everyone else, too. This is critical to me because I believe that salvation is not a solo act. Our liberation is bound up with the liberation of everyone else and, in fact, with the fate of the planet that we share. And so I believe that we can't just be for our own spiritual freedom. We have to be for collective freedom. We can't just be for ourselves alone. In the essay which we excerpted from today, Tom Shade says that Unitarian Universalists have got the personal dimension down. Now, we're always trying to tweak things and make them better, but we know in our congregations how to be caring communities. We know how to nurture one another and encourage one another to grow individually, intellectually, morally, spiritually. But he says we need to do better at helping each person in our Unitarian Universalist congregations connect to the social liberation movements of our own time. The movements are many. He names the Black Lives Matter movement and the movement for climate justice as two examples. To them, we could add the movement for a livable minimum wage, the movement for prison reform, the movement for gun control, the movement for immigrant justice, and so many other movements in support of liberation of those who are marginalized in society in our own time. As this election season progresses and the politics of exclusion and division gain momentum, it seems to me that it is almost more acceptable every day for people to blame their problems on the other. The language of fear and hate degrades us all, but it poses the biggest threat to those who are already vulnerable, those who are already marginalized. More than ever, this election seems to be exposing the urgent need for people to coalesce behind the justice movements of our time. And maybe every generation thinks that. I hear people on the radio say that, and I think every generation thinks that. Maybe it's true. I don't know. What I do know is that we have to find our way to live faithful lives in the time in which we live, in the midst of the challenges in which we live. So we need to nurture our own spirits. I don't want to denigrate that. I think it's really important. I love the transcendentalists and what they have to say, and I do want to commune with divinity all by myself, and I hope that you do too, because I think we can each have a unique revelation of the divine, and we can grow our own souls, and that's really important. And it affects not only our own lives, it affects the lives of the people that we love, the lives of our friends and our family members. It affects our coworkers because it affects how we show up every day in the world in which we live. So that's really important. But so too is the public dimension of our faith, the public dimension of freedom. Now, I don't think that that means we have to go out and do something life-changing like the Sharps did. Though surely there are opportunities, many opportunities abound to radically change your life now and join a movement for the liberation of the human spirit. But the truth is that most of us are not going to do that because we have families and we have jobs and we're in school and we have lives that are rooted in the place that we live, and we're not likely to uproot them to go join a movement for human liberation. Maybe some of us will, and if one of us does, we will cheer them on and raise money for them and send them letters and celebrate their important work in the world, because we do need some people to do that. But the vast majority of us are going to try to figure out how to connect to those movements right here where we live in the midst of our own lives with all of its many demands. And so I want to share with you a term I heard a few years ago when I went to an anti-racist conference. The speaker was Chris Crass. He's an activist, and he wrote a book called Collective Liberation. And in his speech, he said that what we need to be devoted to is the work of micro-liberation. I love that phrase, micro-liberation. Maybe we're not going to go off and go join a movement and devote our lives to it, but we can find ways to practice micro-liberation wherever we are. So when I hear that, I think about tiny acts that we can take on a regular basis, at work with our coworkers, or when we're out with friends and family members, and we hear something, as we surely will every day between now and November, something about hate and fear, we can say something about justice and equity. Just a little something. That's an act of micro-liberation, an act of joining our quest to the quest for liberation of the human spirit. There are countless ways to do that, and I encourage you this week to find ways in your life, at work, around a kitchen table, on a walk with friends. Find ways that you can contribute through tiny acts of micro-liberation to the quest of freedom, not just for yourself, but for everyone. That, I believe, is our calling. Amen, and blessed be. You may have noticed something curious. There is a napkin in your order of service. And it says, social hour, a family affair. When we gather each week, we find ways to extend our hospitality. And social hour is one of the many ways that we do that. And in the coming weeks, we're going to be trying to improve our practice of hospitality, to truly welcome all who join us here in this place. We can't do anything yet about the noise and the crowding, though that's coming. And while it's coming, we're going to try to find some ways that we can improve our welcome. Because what we do here is share our gifts. We share our gifts of time. We share our gifts of talent. When we take the offering, we share our gifts of treasure. And in social hour, we share our gifts of hospitality. I send you with these words attributed to the 19th century universalist John Murray. You may possess a small light, but uncover it and let it shine. Use it in order to bring more light and understanding to the hearts and minds of men and women. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Preach the kindness and everlasting love of God. Go in peace.